get Brexit done on time by the 31st of January. No ifs, no buts, no maybes. Leaving the European Union as one United Kingdom, taking back control of our laws, borders, money, our trade, immigration system, delivering on the democratic mandate of the people.
Boris Johnson today, after a big victory for him. It was a landslide yesterday for the Conservatives. They picked up lots of voters who normally go with the Labour Party. It was the third election in 5 years, and this win by the Tories means the Prime Minister's biggest campaign promise, Brexit, will happen. Joining us now is Dave Lawler, world editor at Axios. Hi.
Hi there.
Also, Henry Olson, columnist at The Washington Post. Hello to you.
Hi.
You're in London, right, Henry? You've been there for a couple of weeks?
I've been here for about a week and a half, yeah. So I got to experience the election firsthand.
And so were people surprised by the results?
They were surprised by the margin of the result. The polls had the Tories ahead pretty much the entire time. But there was thinking that it could be a slim majority, but very few people saw it being, as Boris Johnson said last night, a stonking mandate.
Okay. Dave, what happened? What led to that mandate?
Yeah, so this was an election, as you mentioned, that was fought over the issue of Brexit, and Boris Johnson really ran his campaign on a single line, which was get Brexit done, basically saying everybody's so tired of 3 years of turmoil on this issue. If you vote for me, I will get Brexit done and I will move on to other issues. Now, it's not going to be that simple in practice, but that was certainly an effective slogan, especially given his main opposition party, Labour, had no clear position on Brexit. And the Remain vote, the people who don't like Brexit, that was split between multiple parties, where Boris had the pro-Brexit vote united behind him.
And he seemed to acknowledge today that he may not have these voters forever.
Your hand may have quivered over the ballot paper as before you put your cross in the Conservative box. And you may intend to return to Labour next time round. And if that is the case, I am humbled that you have put your trust in me and that you have put your trust in us.
Henry, are these fair weather voters, or does the Conservative Party have them for a while?
I think that's really up to Boris Johnson and the Conservatives. I think these people have been moving away from Labour for the better part of a decade. This wasn't a one-time switch. And I think they're willing to give the Conservative Party a look. But the look that they want to see is a party that cares about them more than about the interests of financiers and suburbanites. And that means spending money on public service, not raising their tax, spending money on investment, and pouring more money into police and sending jobs their way rather than to London's way. And if the Tories can do that, then I think that they can get these voters a second time.
And Dave, was that the big problem for Labour, that they were seen as the party of a group of people who didn't necessarily have the interests of regular Britons at heart?
I think the main problem for Labour was Jeremy Corbyn, the leader, who is really the most unpopular party leader, according to exit polls, since they've been doing these polls. He was incredibly unpopular. It wasn't just Brexit, which was the key issue for him. There's a real trust deficit in his leadership. He has some very unconventional policies. And so Labour took a hard turn to the left under Corbyn. It wasn't just that his positions were unpopular, but he personally was quite unpopular. I mean, there were seats that had gone to Labour since they were created in the 20s and 30s that went to the Conservatives last night. Now, that's part because people switched from Labour, but not straight to the Conservatives. They voted for third parties, so they stayed away. But there really is a serious bleeding from the Labour heartlands, the people who voted Labour all their lives. Those people are starting to waver, and now Labour has to decide, is this a Corbyn problem? If we get rid of Corbyn, does things change, or is this a deeper problem for us?
Henry, what do you think? What message does that send, this renunciation, this denunciation of Labour?
The denunciation of Labour should send a message to Labour that they need to do more than change the leader, because you had, yes, an unpopular leader, but that was all encapsulated with a series of policies that struck many people in the United Kingdom as unresponsive or wildly fantastic. But that's where the fight is going to go. Corbyn has said he will step down. They're going to hold a leadership camp decision, I believe, in January or certainly in the early part of winter. And Labour will be fighting amongst themselves. Many Labourites who favor what's called the Blue Labour movement, the working class favor wing, will want to take their party back, and we'll see who comes out on top.
And where does this leave the pro-Remain Liberals? Where do they go now?
Well, the Remain cause is pretty much over. Is that, yes, there will be trade negotiations with the EU, but the withdrawal agreement removes Britain from the EU as of the 31st. That will go through, and that means that any attempt to remain means to rejoin. And it, we'll see whether or not there's an appetite for that. That the Liberal Democrats tried to draw that vote to themselves by saying that they would revoke Article 50 and immediately rejoin the EU. And they saw their vote share drop throughout the campaign, which suggests that there's not a hardcore desire to rejoin the EU at this time.
Hmm. So this will all transpire over the next year, right? They will formally and physically exit, I guess, in a year's time?
Well, they formally exited on the 31st. It's the trade negotiations that will continue through to 2020 to determine the future economic relationships with the European Union. But as far as actually being out of the union formally, that happens in January.
Right. But the actual effects of it, that doesn't happen for another year.
Well, the effects of it as far as trade and so forth does not. That's correct. But they can't rejoin. That's the thing is, once they're gone, they'll either be gone completely or they will be gone politically, but they will have a different type of trading relationship. That's what will be decided in 2020.
Somewhat surprisingly, European leaders seem to be happy with the results of this election. Here is a cut of Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, translated.
Et donc la France en particulier.
France is passionately committed to its relationship with the UK, which has been forged through history and geography. Once there's clarity on legal and institutional levels, we'll drive forward together over the next few months and build a common future.
Dave, tell us more about the reaction from Europe.
So Macron has been incredibly frustrated over the last year or so that the entire European agenda, or much of it, has been taken up by this Brexit question. He has big ambitions for European integration, you know, to change the relationship of Europe to the world. And yet he keeps getting dragged to Brussels to bail out the UK at the last minute. This was a pattern that was developing under Theresa May, certainly. And so now I think there are some leaders in Europe who say, look, we had kind of given up on the whole idea that the UK was going to stay in the European Union. We just want to get this done. We want to move the conversation forward. Now, we have a big discussion on trade that's going to take place over the next year or so. But this fundamental question of will they, won't they, is driving all of us crazy in our own domestic politics and in our own world. And so now that the UK has made its decision, there's a little bit more clarity. And I think some of them feel more comfortable with the current reality, even though Boris Johnson may not have been the leader they would have themselves chosen.
But what does it mean practically? Does it mean that they will now treat the UK as any other country, that they will have they'll have to have treaties with the UK, that they'll have to have very complex trade agreements, that they will be in competition with other countries?
Some of it depends on how the negotiations go. So you could see Boris Johnson now with his big mandate go for what people call a soft Brexit, basically, that they keep as much alignment as possible on trade so that the UK is not part of the European Union, but can trade easily with their biggest trading partner, which is the EU. If that happens, you might settle into an easier reality between the UK and EU. Now, I think they will still be renegotiating their relations forever, basically. We've seen with other non-EU members in Europe that this is a very complicated process. But there is a potential there that things could get acrimonious. I mean, Boris Johnson has a domestic constituency now that expects him to deliver on Brexit. They probably are not ready to make too many sacrifices to the EU, particularly his political base. And so you could see tensions rise again between Johnson and people like Macron on this issue.
What about in Britain, Henry, with, for example, Scotland? Scotland has been promising to have an independence vote and to separate from Britain. Is that going to go forward now?
It would need the permission of the United Kingdom. It would need the permission of Parliament in Westminster to go forward, and Boris Johnson refuses to do that. He argues that when it was granted in 2014, it was sold as a once-in-a-generation or a once-in-a-lifetime vote, and he has no intention of giving them a second vote within a decade. But the fact is that the Scots Nationalist Party won 48 of the 59 seats north of the border. They are clearly the party of choice up there. And I think what Johnson needs to do is not just rest on his legal laurels that he can deny a referendum, but he needs to go up to Scotland and persuade people that they actually are better off staying in. And that means investment in and around Glasgow and in places that didn't vote for him and will never vote for him, to show that Scotland is part of the one nation, Britain, that he's been talking about.
When you look at the results of the election, everything we've talked about, and the fortunes or the misfortunes of Labour, what lessons do you draw for the United States?
Well, traditionally, the British and American political systems don't mirror each other perfectly, but they are close enough that you can draw lessons. The sort of voter who switched from Labour to Tory last night is the sort of voter that voted for Trump, and the sort of voter who may have reluctantly voted for a Democrat but isn't happy with the left-wing movement of the party. That the Democrats need to be very concerned about picking somebody who, in an American context, would be viewed as too far left of center. And the other thing is that Johnson did a very concerted outreach for the suburbs. He didn't try and alienate them in any way. Get Brexit done didn't mean leave, leave, leave. It meant we're all tired of it. The decision's been made, and then we're going to pay attention to the whole country. Trump needs to reach out to the suburbs more and emulate Johnson in that respect if he wants to try and guarantee his reelection.
Henry Olson is a columnist at The Washington Post. Dave Lawler is at Axios. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, President Trump opens up millions of acres in California for fracking and oil drilling. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Trump administration is lifting a 5-year ban on hydraulic fracking and oil drilling on more than a million acres of federal land across Central California in Fresno, Kern, Santa Barbara, and Bakersfield counties. One parcel is near Yosemite, another near the Sequoia National Park. Well, environmentalists are outraged, and so is California Attorney General Javier Becerra, who says he'll fight it. Here to talk about this is Char Miller. He's professor of environmental analysis at Pomona College. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, tell us about this land and why the administration is doing this.
Well, there's a couple of things at play. First of all, let's talk about fracking as a technology, which admittedly opens up wells that in many cases seem to have been played out. And so industry loves this new technology. It's actually an old technology, but the new application of it that has done remarkable work for them in pulling oil out of the ground and gas out of the ground that they didn't think they could manage. So that's the tech side. The politics of this are even more interesting because, again, this is California, and because this is a Trump administrative play, no one can avoid the fact that this is in direct response to Governor Newsom's argument that fracking would be under scientific review in the state of California. And here's the federal government sort of suggesting that its power overwhelms that of the state. So in the end, we're going to see a lot of lawsuits.
Lawsuits based on states' rights versus federal sovereignty.
Yeah, I think, you know, the irony, of course, is not missed on anyone that this is a states' rights argument at one level. But it's also a question about the rulings in 2014 that set aside the BLM's decision, original decision, to approve fracking up along the Central Coast and elsewhere. The BLM now says it has complied with the court order, but that whether it fully complied is probably going to be the technical part part of the lawsuit, but the other will be Becerra, as he has been doing repeatedly since 2017, is going to sue to challenge this and basically to bog down any federal action in the state of California.
Okay, so does that mean nothing's going to happen until these lawsuits go forward?
Well, I think that's what it means, because that's what it has meant in other instances in different ways. So, you know, whether the Ninth Circuit will hear this, I don't know, but I assume that's where these suits will go to. And, you know, that's been tends to be sympathetic to the arguments that California has been making about the environment over the years, and actually other states under its jurisdiction. So my guess is this is going to end in court. My guess is that by keeping it in court, this becomes a way by which to slow the process down, certainly until 2020 elections. And if a White House is flipped, then I think California, among other places, will breathe a sigh of relief.
But in general, this is federal land. Do
yes.
the feds have the ability to do whatever they want with it, even if it is in
yeah.
a state?
Yeah, that's sort of the sticking point, because the Bureau of Land Management, since the early 19th century, has had control of all mineral rights under federal property everywhere. And this is federal property. But the state of California in last month, in fact, Governor Newsom said the moratorium on fracking will review all permits in the state. And that includes federal lands. So it's not clear to me the legal jurisdiction or the legal legitimacy of that claim. But I think that will also be adjudicated in the courts.
In general, though, pre-Governor Newsom, Governor Brown was pretty open to allowing fracking in California, right?
He was, and that drove many of us crazy, because the sort of green perspective that he promoted and frankly did on a lot of good issues seemed to be in conflict. And his argument was that oil and gas have been crucial to California's economy. We want to continue that process, even though, on the other hand, we're talking about trying to become more carbon free. And I think that in the end is going to be one of the central issues in the public debate, which is the same moment in which COP25 is meeting in Barcelona, and the United States is fundamentally absent from that global conversation about how to move towards a carbon-free economy. The Trump administration is demonstrating once again that it is most interested in being retrogressive, and that it perceives that oil and gas are the way to go, and the world be damned.
But then you have localities which are hurting financially, like Kern County, and the Board of Supervisors there unanimously approved a measure to bring the oil industry in to present their plans. So you've got on a local level, you've got some lawmakers really wanting this to happen.
Yeah, you do. And I fully appreciate their desires to make that work. We've seen this in the past in logging areas, for example, in the 1980s and 1990s, when clear cutting was cut back, literally, and logging towns suffered enormously as a consequence. And part of what I think any good state policy and, frankly, Fed policy needs to do is to think very seriously about the economic impact on localities on the one hand, set against the broader interests, in this case, carbon-free economy in a climate-changed world, and do some serious thinking about this. You know, in the early 1920s, just to name a person, Gifford Pinchot, who had been the first head of the Forest Service, wrote quite poignantly about the logging towns in Pennsylvania that had turned up empty because all of the lands had been deforested. And he was very concerned about those kind of economic ramifications. And we need to take that seriously. I guess that's the larger point, is we've got to take it seriously, and there has to be a way by which to negotiate this process. Wholesale opening up public lands to fracking is not that policy. It is a kind of political payback that I think will not work to the president's advantage.
Char, thanks for coming on today.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thanks, Madeline.
Char Miller, professor of environmental analysis at Pomona College. Coming up, how a family in Mexico City tries to survive by operating their own ambulance.
They, you know, wait on a street corner to hear about accidents, and when something comes through, will literally be chasing competitor ambulances down these kind of traffic-filled streets to an accident.
The director of the new documentary, Midnight Family, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In Mexico City, a city of some 9 million people, there are 45 government-owned ambulances. Just 45. So private ambulances literally race to pick up the slack, even though many of their passengers don't have insurance or money to pay them. The Ochoa family owns and operates one of these private ambulances. And filmmaker Luke Lawrenson rode along with them for 3 years to make a documentary about their experiences. And the movie is called Midnight Family. Luke Lawrenson joins me now. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how did you meet the Ochoas?
I was living in Mexico City at the time and quite spontaneously woke up one morning and parked just in front of my apartment building was this family-run ambulance. And I was kind of curious about what, you know, a family was doing with their own medical service. And so I asked them if I could ride along for a night. And that evening, I was in this ambulance whizzing around the city, seeing this whole underworld of for-profit healthcare that was filling a gap left by a really dysfunctional government health system.
It really is remarkable to see them at work. Can you just describe what a typical night is like?
So the Ochoa family consists of Fair, who's the father. He's kind of in his mid-40s, and his son, Juan, is 17 and is kind of the main driver and lead EMT. And they bring along with them, you know, a 9-year-old little brother, Josue, who's kind of also helps out with the family business. And they, you know, wait on a street corner to hear about accidents. And when something comes through, will literally be chasing competitor ambulances down these kind of traffic-filled streets to an accident. And, you know, they will sometimes be, these private ambulances will sometimes be the only ambulances to arrive. And they will transport people to a hospital and try to charge for that service. But what you see in the film is that this family is barely able to make ends meet. And their kind of financial insecurity starts to raise some really big ethical questions in terms of, you know, what they need to do to kind of survive.
What are some of those ethical questions?
Well, you know, first and foremost, they have to ask people on the spot, sometimes people who have just lost a loved one, for payment, which is always a deeply uncomfortable, you know, process. And less than 30% of those people actually end up paying. And so they find other ways to kind of make ends meet. And one of those big ways is there are also private hospitals that need patients and will pay commissions for patients, and those hospitals won't always be the closest or, you know, the best option. I would be in this ambulance and I would be pulled in so many different emotional directions. There would be nights where I felt like this family was doing hero's work, and there were other nights where the kind of ways they treated patients made me deeply uncomfortable. And part of editing the film was to kind of explore both of those emotions and the tensions between them, and show that this is a family that doesn't quite have the luxury to always do the right thing.
Well, I guess you could compare it to the American system. I mean, in certain circumstances, when you call an ambulance here, you're not asked to pay on the spot, but you do have to pay later.
You have to pay a lot later. And in some ways, when I, you know, was making this film, I started to feel like this is, you know, a portrait of free market healthcare and kind of a warning call to what happens when money is so deeply, you know, meshed into the care of people. And in the U.S., we are far from a system where, you know, the amount you can pay, you know, it determines the care you get.
Hmm. Well, so if less than 30% pay, they're really living on the margin, this family. Do you ever think, well, it's not worth it?
You know, they have invested so much into this business. You know, just buying an ambulance, getting uniforms, getting equipment is, you know, really been something they've worked for years and years. And, you know, Juan, this 17-year-old, he dropped out of middle school to work as an EMT with his father. So they don't really have, you know, many other options. This is what they've decided to do. You know, they're also proud of it in a way. The city needs them. And, you know, they are showing up to accidents on a regular basis where no other ambulances are showing up. And, you know, they take pride in that part of it, too.
Do they have medical training?
The father in the family got into this whole business through working with the Mexican Red Cross and was trained through that process. And he's really been the one to teach 17-year-old Juan and the kind of the rest of the family what they know.
I want you to talk a little bit about the dynamics between the three of them, because in some instances, it's really funny. They just have this kind of funny relationship where the power dynamic is upended in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Sometimes 9-year-old Josue will upbraid his father and actually have to give his father money out of his own wallet.
Yeah. So, you know, what brought me to this story and what interested me first and foremost was that this was a family drama. You know, this was a story of an unlikely family, you know, trying to survive in the world. And just the way that Juan and Josue and Fer, who are kind of the three main characters of the film and are the, you know, the family, interact is highly amusing and sometimes also really tough. You know, Juan has taken this business into his own hands and is kind of bossing his older father around throughout the film and telling him to do better, telling him to get his paperwork together and to clean his uniform. And then little Josue, who's 9 years old, is sometimes paying for things because he's, you know, the last one to always have some spare cash. He doesn't have as many expenses as his, you know, his older siblings. So they've kind of come up with this own system that works for them as a family, but is really unusual.
Well, what is Josue doing there? Because it seems like he's just along for the fun and the thrill of it. He's not really attending to the patients. He's 9 years old.
This is where his family is. You know, he can't just be at home alone all night while the rest of his family's out working. You know, he is there because he wants to be with his family. And it's also at times exciting for him, but it's also at times really terrifying. You know, he's probably seen more suffering and kind of trauma than most people have in a lifetime. And he hasn't even, you know, made it through middle school.
You spent 3 years with them.
I spent 3 years on and off. I met them at the end of 2015 and filmed for long periods of time all the way through the beginning of 2018 and have stayed really closely in touch since. It's, you know, almost 4 years to the date that I met them.
And so now that this has become a movie and a movie that has been praised by critics and seen by lots and lots of people, have their fortunes changed?
Their kind of everyday reality is more or less the same. They'll go through periods where things are going really well for them, and then they'll go through periods where things are really tough. And the film has not yet been released properly in Mexico and will be in early next year. And I think that will really be a time where attention will be given to this healthcare system that has really been under the radar. There are so few people in Mexico City that know where their ambulances come from. And, you know, I hope that this story will bring light to that and also just bring light to a family trying to live inside a corrupt system and, you know, to show that government dysfunction on a really high level trickles down to people on the street level and really determines the life and death of people.
How did you find out that there were only 45 government-operated ambulances? And this isn't 45 government-operated ambulance systems. It is ambulances as in the trucks.
Yeah, it's a great question because it took a lot of work to get that number. And what these institutions report on their websites is, you know, inflated numbers. And so I just went to every single institution in Mexico City that offers emergency ambulance services, and I counted them. And it's fewer than 45. There are some nights where that number drops way lower. And, you know, if there is, you know, God forbid, a really big disaster in the city, their kind of upper limit is around 45.
Wow. And any reason for that?
You know, it's Mexico promises free health care to all. But the moment you kind of look into that system, you see that they are not really providing the kind of infrastructure for the number of people that rely on this system. And ambulances are a piece of that much larger system where kind of corruption and government dysfunction has just failed to give people the, you know, the services they need.
And this is your first film, right?
It's my first film out of school. I made some student films, but this is kind of the big one.
Well, you did really well for yourself for your first movie.
Thank you.
How did you know how to shoot it? Because the photography is beautiful.
Well, thank you. I shot it as a one-person crew, which posed an enormous number of challenges, but it was kind of the only way to fit in this ambulance. And there were also some really big emotional and ethical challenges that I faced that I just would never have felt comfortable bringing a full crew into. But some of my first professional work out of school was as a cinematographer, and so I had kind of learned that skill set before anything else.
Because you plant a camera on the hood of the truck, so you can see into the front window. You can see the faces of Juan and Fair as they're sitting, driver and co-pilot.
Yeah, I came up with this system that would kind of film multiple angles in the ambulance at once, and so I had two cameras rolling simultaneously. One was mounted on the hood, and another was with me in the back, because I knew that my characters would be sometimes driving, sometimes treating patients, and I needed to be able to cross cover all of that. And it took weeks and weeks of trying things and failing before coming up with kind of a system that worked. But the family's routine was really repetitive, and it kind of enabled me to take big risks and have them not pan out without totally losing the story, which is not the case with a lot of observational films. So that was a really lucky thing to have.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. That's Luke Lawrenson. He's the director of the new documentary, Midnight Family. It's in theaters today. Joining me now is Warren Olney, host of To the Point, the podcast.
Hello.
And what's on your show this week?
Well, you know, there's a wonderful book about Abraham Lincoln called Lincoln and His Generals, and it's all about how he took over the Civil War and began to run it. Now there's a book called Trump and His Generals, and the subtitle is The Cost of Chaos. It's by Peter Bergen, CNN, and other connections. He did 100 interviews for this book. There's a lot of stuff in it about the kinds of conversations that went on in the Pentagon, in the decision room, which they call the tank, I think, in the Pentagon, and how this bromance that he had, more generals in Trump's cabinet than any other president in history, he with no military experience whatsoever and had never served in public office. And all of a sudden you begin to hear how the bromance goes sour.
Yes.
It's a very interesting book, very interesting conversation with Peter Bergen.
And not just with the generals inside the White House, but the generals at the Pentagon as well.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, of course, the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis.
All right. Listen to that fascinating conversation on To the Point, the podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. That means it's time to talk new movies. Tim Grierson is here, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Hello.
Hello.
And Christy Lemire is film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hello to you.
Hi, good to see you.
Let us start with Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems. He plays a jewelry store owner and a compulsive gambler.
I made a crazy risk to gamble. And it's about to pay off. So I want the Celtics to cover. I want the Celtics halftime. I want Garnett points and rebounds. What do you know?
I don't know. I just know.
All right, Christy.
Yes.
His character, Howard, he seems like a lovable loser.
I'm not sure he's even lovable, but he's rootable. Like, you get deeply invested in what he is doing and you want to see him succeed and come through at the other end intact. Adam Sandler doing the absolute best work of his life.
Really?
I would venture to say he will get nominated for an Oscar. I would not be shocked if he won.
Didn't he say if he wasn't nominated, he would go make a terrible movie?
And he's going to do that anyway.
Right.
But hopefully this is like a turning point for Adam Sandler. He can see what life is like when, you know, when you do serious, solid, good work and people like it. He plays this jeweler in Manhattan who is like, his whole life is like a Ponzi scheme. Like, he's got one ring that he's got in pawn to pay off the gambling debt so he can then bet on something else, and he's got all these plates spinning at once. He's got a wife and a girlfriend, and it all takes place over the course of just a few days, and it's how will he get away with this without getting killed by the bad guys who want money from him. And yet you see, it's a deeply disturbing and fascinating portrait of addiction, of neediness, of like striving and trying to fill the void in your life, and nothing is ever good enough. It's so good. The supporting cast is great. Kevin Garnett is good in this.
Playing himself.
Yes. He played this movie set in 2012 when he's still part of the Boston Celtics. He wants to borrow the rare black opal that Howard has because he wants to sell it because he's going to pay off his debts with this thing that he thinks he can sell for like $1 million. Garnett is convinced it's a good luck charm for him on the court, so he takes it. Howard has to get the stone back along with all the other things that Christy described. This is my favorite movie of the year. I think it's fantastic. I do not think he's going to get nominated, unfortunately. But
he'll get nominated.
I don't think he's going
to.
Because this movie is the feel stressed movie of the year. This movie is like 2 hours and 10 minutes of high anxiety. That trailer actually does a pretty good job of capturing the intensity of this is a man with his hair on fire for 2 hours and 10 minutes who has these addictions, has these problems, is not interested in changing or growing. He just moves forward. He's convinced he's going to make this big sale. He's going to turn his life around.
It's like the one last caper kind of thing.
Kind of. And what's fascinating, like Christy said, like, he is a character you would not want in your life. He would destroy everything that you care about. But he is incredibly fascinating and compelling. And Sandler is just fantastic. And it's funny to watch him after so many years of playing like immature kind of adolescent characters. This is like a grown-up version of that type of person who's a much more like troubled individual. It's like a real person as opposed to like the caricatures he's done in his other films. I think the film is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, Josh and Benny Safdie, brothers who have made a lot of indie films for a while, they wanted Adam Sandler to do this film for like 10 years and they couldn't get him. And they finally got him. After this, they saw Punch Drunk Love. They wanted this for him and they finally got him. And the Safdies, this is like the best movie they've ever made.
Yeah.
It's the most mature movie they've ever made, but they make these really like deeply lived in, like seedy, rich New York stories. Mm-hmm. And this is that on just a grand scale. You've got to see it in a theater, the way it's edited, the score, it's just this totally overwhelming experience if you want to be stressed out for 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Well, okay. I mean, why not? We are in general in our lives, so just keep it going.
This is stylishly so.
Okay, Uncut Gems. Go see it. Moving on to something that seems like it could be the exact opposite, A Hidden Life, a historical film by Terrence Malick about an Austrian farmer who refused to fight for the Nazis in World War II.
You cannot say no to your race and your hope. You are a traitor.
I can't swear loyalty to Hitler. I can't.
Do you think your defiance will change the course of things?
If God gives us free will, we're responsible for what we do.
Well, so in real life, Tim, this man named Franz was beatified by the Catholic Church.
Yes, he was a conscientious objector. He refused to serve in the Nazi army during World War II. He sacrificed his life for his principles. And this movie is by Terrence Malick, which is interesting because he is a man who's made several films about God and God's place in our world. And what is interesting about A Hidden Life is that this is a movie that basically asks the question, if you have these principles, if you feel like you cannot do this thing, but it will cost you your life, doesn't make a difference in the end, because the war still went on. Nothing really kind of happened. But this man, wanted to stand up and say no. And it's 3 hours long. And this is a very interesting kind of movie because it does take a lot of time. This is like the exact opposite of Uncut Gems. This is a movie that's very sort of meditative. And if you know a Terrence Malick movie, you kind of know what you're going to expect. There's going to be roving like cameras and things like that. There's going to be a lot of voiceover and things like that. If you have been not on the Malick train for the last decade or so, this movie will not get you back on the train. It's not one of Malick's best, but it's incredibly thoughtful and moving in a lot of ways.
It is his best since Tree of Life, though. I do agree with you on that. And I am back on the Malick train. Those last three films prior to this, they're all kind of a piece, right? And they had characters and kind of and actors and scenarios that kind of overlap with each other. It was a lot of like beautiful, skinny people looking out the window of boutique hotels wistfully. Looking sad. And yeah, and there's style in that, but there's also really maddening self-indulgence in that. And this has all of the beautiful, rapturous style and the meditative beauty that you want in a Terrence Malick movie, but with more narrative drive. There's more momentum to it. And yes, it is 3 hours long, but I would argue that it is not entirely totally different from Uncut Gems because there is a steadily building tension here. There is a question of what's going to happen to this man. And a lot of that is what we experience through his wife, played by Valerie Packner, who has to, you know, fight for him, who has to take care of the farm, take care of the kids, and keep life going, not knowing if she will ever see her husband again. And so there is a quietly building tension. It's not like the bam, bam, bam of an Uncut Gem, certainly, but you do feel increasingly in your heart this anxiety for this woman and what's going to happen to her. But yeah, it is gorgeous, and it is 3 hours long.
Can we just take a pause, speaking of length, and just, I want to ask you, why are these movies now so long? I just sat through The Irishman. I didn't think I could do it in one sitting. And in fact, I didn't. But
that's not how Scorsese wanted you to see it, Madeline.
Yeah, I know. But that's the reality. Netflix came to my rescue. So why? Why are these movies now so bloated time-wise?
It is award season. There is an implicit sense of heft to these films, which the filmmakers decide requires a larger canvas, you know, that time equals importance, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it depends kind of case by case. I think with both Irishman and A Hidden Life, there's something to be said for you have to kind of live in the world of these characters for a while so that when you get to the end, you really feel like, oh, I've lived a long time with these people.
And so lived a long life.
Yeah, but the weight of what happens at the end, I think in both cases. Now, you know, Michael Bay can make 90-minute movies. I would encourage Michael Bay to make 90-minute movies. But some of these, I think, actually work at the length that they are. I think the problem is that when movies like these do well during award season, people think, oh, well, my movie needs to be 4 hours long or 5 hours long.
They used to have intermissions.
Yeah.
These movies.
Hateful Eight had an intermission.
Yeah, people always ask me why there aren't intermissions anymore. And I don't actually know the answer to that because I feel like theaters would sell popcorn and stuff like that. And I don't know why that is that we don't have intermissions.
I have a guess, because maybe that eats up more time and they can get maybe like one less showing in per day.
That's probably what it is. It always comes down to money. All right. Next up, Clint Eastwood's Richard Jewell, based on the true story of the security guard who discovered a bomb at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta.
You always look at the guy who found the bomb just like you always look at the guy who found the body.
Jewell fits the profile of the lone bomber,
a frustrated white man who is a police wannabe who seeks to become a hero.
We're running it.
You're a suspect. You don't talk.
I talk. Say it.
I don't talk.
This might be the only way to clear your name. I want you to say there's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes.
Okay, so Christy, let's begin with the controversy surrounding this film, because Olivia Wilde plays a journalist, the late Kathy Scruggs from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, trading sex with the FBI agent played by Don Draper in this movie, John Hamm. No evidence this happened in real life. It did not happen, in fact. And yet this is in the movie and journalists and everyone are pretty much outraged by
it. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the editor of the newspaper, put out a statement asking Warner Brothers, like, this did not happen. This is a misrepresentation. This is a besmirching of a woman's name. And she can't defend herself. She died several years ago. And Warner Brothers said, pretty much, it's a movie. Deal with it. And there is no even cursory warning at the beginning. Like so many films will say, even a one-line title card, like, inspired by true events. this doesn't even do that. So what it is putting forth suggests this is absolute truth. What you're watching is truth. And no, there's no reason to believe that she ever slept with an FBI agent, who, by the way, is a fictionalized character. Kathy Scruggs is named, the woman that Olivia Wilde is playing. And she's an interesting enough figure, from all accounts, to not have to put this false element into her story. And it's not like it's a throwaway bit in a subplot. It is a totally crucial element to the story. When she sleeps with John Hamm, and we know she does because he whispers information in her ear and then they arrange to go have sex right afterward, she's then able to waltz back in the newsroom with this scoop. And that changes everything in terms of how this case got expedited and magnifying the anxiety this person, you know, experienced. Anyway, it's
so the paper apparently wants them to put a disclaimer on the movie.
And they won't do it.
Yes, and they've sued Warner Brothers, and that's going on right now. I mean, what's also frustrating is I think that's actually the worst part of the movie just regardless. Like, when I saw this movie 3-4 weeks ago, I was one of the first people who saw it, and so there wasn't the time to actually, like, look up all this information about Kathy Scruggs. And so I thought, oh, this must not be a real person. It's a composite or whatever. Because what Clint Eastwood is doing in the movie is basically saying that both the FBI and the media persecuted Richard Jewell in the public's eye. He never went to trial. People just assumed he was guilty. Mm-hmm. And so the press, the way the press is sort of portrayed in this movie, is very much like, they're jackals. They're terrible. They're just kind of going for sensation. And so to have the Olivia Wilde character do these things, it really kind of plays into this like stacked deck of, well, you know how the media are.
They're in cahoots.
They're in cahoots.
They're colluding with the deep state.
Yeah, they're basically like lying all the time or basically kind of acting unethically, which is really, really kind of like frustrating in the film. I mean, the film itself, I think, actually works pretty decently. It doesn't need this. And as Christy said, other characters in the movie are composites or completely fictionalized. I'm shocked that Warner Brothers said, why don't we just name her anything other than Kathy Scruggs and just make it just like a fictionalized sort of thing, and then we'll save ourselves a lot of headaches. I don't know what kind of clout Clint Eastwood has over Warner Brothers. A decent amount, I imagine.
There's a building named for him.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, the fact is that, as Christy said, Warner Brothers, their response has basically been, you know, it's kind of ironic that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is acting this way when they were the ones who were persecuting Richard Jewell and now accusing our filmmakers of doing the same thing to them. That's the type of clout that Clint Eastwood has, that Warner Brothers is basically like backing him all the way. Again, I think this movie actually works. I think Paul Walter Hauser is really good as Richard Jewell. I think Sam Rockwell is really good as the lawyer. Again, these are real people. The movie doesn't need this. The movie doesn't need this. And so to just needlessly just kind of pick at a person. This woman died in 2001. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution was still dealing with a lawsuit from Richard Jewell at the time that she died. They were exonerated later after her death. And at that time, people said, you know, she would have loved to have seen this, to realize that she was right all along, and that this lawsuit that Richard Jewell had filed against her and the rest of the people at the newspaper, that they were right, that they were vindicated. The fact that 18 years later, like, her family and friends still have to kind of go through this is incredibly gross.
So the subtext, we're talking about the subtext in the Terrence Malick movie about fighting fascism. There's a subtext here, too, but on the other side.
In terms of what? I'm sorry.
Well, Clint Eastwood being a Republican Party activist and then portraying the FBI and the media as the villains.
Yeah. And as you say, we don't need any of that because the story itself is compelling enough and the performances are strong enough that I don't think we... Yeah. And Paul Walter Hauser is great as Richard Jewell. We don't need... The film does not need this controversy. They brought it upon themselves.
So aside from that, is it a good movie?
Solid.
Yeah, I think it's very much late period Clint Eastwood. It's very simplistic. There's not a lot of nuance to it, but it has a good story to tell, and it tells that story A, B, C, D. It's, you know, Clint Eastwood is very much known for doing like one take for everything, and the movie very much moves along very succinctly, and you feel the things you're supposed to feel in the right moments in the movie. But yeah, it's like a lot of his recent stuff. It's not amazing, but it's solid. And it's interesting because Clint Eastwood, whether it's American Sniper or 1517 to Paris or Sully, he's really invested in true life heroes who were not given sort of their fair shake and wanting to kind of give them their moment in the sun.
Rehabilitate them.
Yeah. And especially for a movie like this, to do that and then pick on someone who's been gone for 20 years, it just seems like you're halfway there, Mr. Eastwood, but why vilify another person to do that? That just seems unnecessary.
Okay, finally, Jumanji, The Next Level, starring The Rock.
This next venture is even more challenging. Now remember, the future of Jumanji is in your hands.
I have one important question. Who is Jumanji?
Is that Barbara's boy?
We're gonna die.
We did die.
Are we in hell?
I knew it.
Oh my God.
Okay, anything to say about this?
Well, the controversy about this movie, there's no controversy. No, I will say this. I had not seen the movie before this, Jumanji : Welcome to the Jungle. Mm-hmm. It's actually really delightful, I have to say. I have been told by people it's really good, and it's really fun, and it's really smart, and it's surprisingly emotional. It's about these teenagers who get sucked into a game, and their avatars are Dwayne Johnson and Jack Black and, you know, and Kevin Hart. And it's fun to watch these big stars essentially play teenagers, insecure teenagers. That was a really fun conceit in the first movie. The second one, the problem is, why do they go back to the game? It's not really well explained. Some of the characters switch avatars this time. So if you like someone playing Dwayne Johnson, another person's going to play them this time. It's like a lot of sequels. It's not as funny. It's not as fresh. It makes you think, I wish they had just stuck with the first one. This one is just less good in every way.
There is a funny bit, though, because we have, besides the teenagers getting sucked into the game, we have Danny DeVito and Danny Glover getting sucked into the game. And so the funniest bit for me the whole way through was Kevin Hart channeling Danny Glover, because it's such a different vibe for him and a different pace for him. And so he's having to slow it down. Like this. And he's the zoologist character, so he takes forever to explain why ostriches are menacing or whatever. So that bit worked for me the whole time. Karen Gillan, I like. She's got a great physical presence about her. She's one of the avatars, too. Yeah, why do this? I don't know. But it was fun. I laughed.
Awkwafina is a new cast member, and Awkwafina is very fun because she's an avatar, and she plays two different characters in it. And the range of the two people that she has to play is really, really funny. It might be, I mean, The Farewell, she's really good in that. I don't want to diminish that. But this is more of a straight comedy performance. And this is I think she's actually really funny in it. When the inevitable third movie comes out, I'll be looking forward to seeing her again in that one. But
maybe Adam Sandler will be in that one.
It's 2 hours of him being chased by ostriches.
He's still trying to find that opal somewhere. Yes.
Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Christy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jumanji, it's the jungle inside your soul. Somewhere deep inside at the end of the world.
Jumanji. Okay, Jack Black, Nick Jonas there in the song Jumanji, Jumanji. That does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Alex Trigvadottir, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Rebecca Mooney, and Danielle Chiriguayo. Michelle Aloy is our line editor, Sarah Sweeney our managing producer, Amy Ta our digital producer, Mario Saavedra is our technical director, and Mike Stark engineered for us this week. Don't forget, you can listen to Press Play on podcast at kcrw.com. I'll see you on Monday.